Welcome, listeners, to Bruin Radio Interviews, an hour-long interview show brought to you by the students and staff of the Brookings Harbor High School in partnership with Curry Coast Community Radio, KCIW. Content for this program is provided by the Brookings Harbor High School.
This is Bruin Radio Interviews. I am Isabella Freitas, and I'm here with
Iris Mitchell.
And we are here today with Pastor Jim Schultz. Welcome.
Hello. Good to be here.
So, we would like to start by asking you about your Chetco bar fire story.
I was throwing a frisbee to my dog, Bodie, best dog who ever lived. He's a blue heeler. And noticing red skies and something falling from them. And I didn't know what it was. I wasn't listening to the radio. I didn't know what was going on. And I looked at our trampoline, which is black, and I could see that there were bits of ash. What in the world is going on here? So I clicked on a radio or something, or got online, and immediately found out that this fire was raging just several miles from where we camp and ride dirt bikes and everything. Like, just, you know, because we like to go up where the... At the fork right there, the third bridge, and this was just a few miles away. And as the story unfolded, anyway, we ended up with some friends of ours. You guys probably know Haley Socher, who graduated here last year, and then Christina Davis. Well, their parents are good buds with us, and their kids are about our kids' age. They're our camping buddies, and they had just like a few weeks before that moved upriver, and they're being told to evacuate. So. They ended up coming to our place and setting up their camper right there between our house and the church. And then this other family came, and then we opened the doors to the firemen. And we had, you know, crews of firemen and firewomen who were going out fighting this fire at night and then coming and trying to sleep during the day. But some of them, you know, couldn't quite just go to sleep right away, so they'd, like, unwind for a while. We'd talk to them and just sort of... I tried to get him to play ping pong, but that was a little too noisy for the ones trying to sleep, you know. But I just admired their bravery. They're telling us these stories about crawling around in the mountains at dark, wild animals, trying to get away from the fire, too. One time they got almost surrounded, so they had to get out of there early. I was just blown away by the risks that they were taking to save our necks. I was so appreciative of that. And if we all were. I mean, it could have gone a lot worse, couldn't it?
Could have, yeah. I would like to play some ping pong.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, we should all just go play ping pong.
Right now.
So, we hear that you're pro-life. Could you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember when I became a pro-lifer, I was going into my sixth grade year, and... a bunch of us watched this film called The Silent Scream. It was made by Bernard Nathanson, MD. He ran the largest abortion clinic in the Western Hemisphere. He co-founded NARAL in the late 60s and early 70s to try to get abortion rights. he performed thousands of abortions. But he became pro-life in the course of time. And as somewhere during that transitional phase, ultrasound technology was becoming well-developed, and so the film was based on him filming an ultrasound of the abortion of a 12-week gestation little girl. And we watched as the suction tip was inserted into the womb, and that little girl started squirming like she was trying to get away from that suction tip. But she couldn't, and it ripped her leg off. And then it ripped another off, and then it ripped portions of her torso down till nothing was left inside but the skull. And of course, at that point, they inserted forceps and crushed the head to pieces and then removed them one by one. I was watching the dismemberment of a human being, and I was shaken to my core. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and I couldn't believe it was legal to do this. And that people thought we were bad for opposing this. I instantly became a pro-lifer based on what I saw with my eyes. And then after that, of course, I heard arguments. The argument I use today is it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Therefore, abortion is wrong. no one objects to the first premise that it's wrong to kill an innocent human being. But pro-choicers object to the second premise that abortion intentionally kills a human being. And there are various ways that they try to undermine that argument. And I don't think any of those methods work. I've read a lot of pro-choicers in my life, and I find their arguments wanting.
So, you said, like, an innocent human being, an abortion aims to kill an innocent human being. At what point do you think, would you say that a fertilized egg in the womb becomes a human being?
Embryology speaks with one voice that upon fertilization, a distinct human being comes into existence. I've combed through a number of embryology texts to confirm this myself. Langman's Embryology, Sadler, Moran Prasad. These aren't Christian pro-life sources. These are the ones that you use if you're going to medical school and you want to, you know, study embryology. So, but the other thing is I just looked at something Maureen Condick put together. It's a 12-page document. Maureen Condick is an MD, she teaches at the University of Utah. And she combed through not just the embryology text, but she combed through peer-reviewed journals that other scientists read about these matters. And she's got 12 pages of quotes and documentation. And all of them agree. I read through it a couple weeks ago. All of them agree that a human being comes into existence upon fertilization. Now, they might differ on the exact moment. Is it syngamy when the actual genetic code, you've got the gametes, DNA, and they come together, and when they merge, that's syngamy. You have a unique genetic code at that point. Some people say it happens even a few moments before, minutes before, really. But once the male gamete, gets through the zona pellucida, and the zona pellucida then hardens to keep the other sperm out. But when they join together and you have a distinct genetic code, that's at the latest, that's when a human starts to exist. So we're basing our case on science, not blind faith or religious presuppositions that other people don't embrace. We make our case from science and philosophy, at least I think good pro-life defenders do.
I gotta leave real quick. Thank you all for listening to my couple seconds on the radio.
So you mentioned earlier the term embryology. Do you think you could briefly expand on this for people listening that might not know what that is?
Yes. Embryology is the science that studies development at the embryonic stage, which means like during the first several weeks of gestation. I mean, when you have a fertilized egg, the moment of conception, it's called a zygote at first, but you're still in the embryonic phase for several weeks before you move on to the fetus stage.
So you gave us your reasons on why you are pro-life, but what would you define pro-life as specifically?
Let's say pro-life means that you support the right of every human being to live. It is a pro-equality stance. It makes no distinction between humans that have to be protected and humans that ought not to be protected. There is simply no distinction. We are the full equality group who says no matter what gender you are, no matter what age you are, no matter what stage of development you are, no matter what capacities you can currently exercise or not, no matter how smart you are or how not smart, no matter, there is simply no factor other than being human that means you have a right to life and ought to be protected by law from fertilization through death. That's a pro-lifer. And so, of course, that has to do with a great many things. It has implications for assisted suicide, embryonic stem cell research. There are a lot of areas of bioethics, cloning, of course. And obviously, it has implications for feeding the poor and caring for the vulnerable in our society and all those sorts of things, too. So we want to be comprehensive in our pro-life interests. But we're also highly targeted, many of us highly dedicated to overturning abortion laws and informing people so that they wouldn't want abortion if it were legal. so that they know what abortion really is and why it's wrong.
So I would take it that there are no scenarios that you could think of in which you might condone someone getting an abortion.
I remember years ago, I would have said that theoretically to save the life of a mother, because it's better that one person dies than two people, of course. But then I read something from C. Everett Koop. He was the Surgeon General of the United States during the Reagan administration. And he said in all his decades in the medical field, he had never seen a case when abortion was necessary to save a mother's life. And it made me wonder, okay, how often does that really come up? Statistically, it's cited in maybe 3 or 4% of abortions or less. So I'll say theoretically, if that were the only way to save her life, of course. But if it's not, if there's some other way where both lives can be saved, that's what I would think is the best way.
Okay. That is a good point. Okay. So has anyone ever come up to you saying that they would like to get an abortion and then they were asking for maybe your viewpoint or your help?
I know people who have had abortions. I didn't know them before the fact. So I can't say that is the case. I helped found the Pregnancy Care Center here in Brookings, though, in 2004. We planted it out of the Crescent City Pregnancy Care Center. And then I served on the board of directors for 4 years, 3 as the chairman of the board. My job in that organization wasn't meeting with men and women. It was hiring and firing executive directors and policies, procedures, fundraising, running the Pregnancy Care Center banquet. I got to meet Norma McCorvey, who is Roe of Roe versus Wade in that context. But I wasn't the front lines in meeting with women in that room. I was enabling that to happen. But it's you do that so that's available. That kind of compassion, that's the front line. That's where people need help. That's what, you know, when a woman says she can't have this baby, you know, she may have any number of factors in mind, including financial issues, including not knowing how to be a parent. And the Pregnancy Care Center, its purpose was to come alongside and sort of like be an extension of her family at that moment, to provide material help, training, encouragement, information, referrals for adoption, anything that she needed, and he needed as well.
If you met someone that was planning to have an abortion, but do you have anything that you have thought of that you would like to say to someone that planned to have an abortion?
That was planning to?
Yes.
I would ask them if they know what abortion is. And then I would listen to their response until they ran out of air. And then if they didn't know what abortion was or what the unborn are, because I think if you're going to have an informed opinion about abortion, you have to know what the unborn are and what happens to the unborn during an abortion. I would tell them if they were at all unclear about what it was. Most people who know what it is reject it. Certainly most people who see it on film reject it. That's been our experience showing abortion videos to people. So, yeah, I would try to talk the person into life. Very, very clearly I would do that, but I would show as much compassion as I possibly could, because I understand. I understand we all make mistakes. We all commit sins, you know. I'm pretty bad at sinning myself. So bad. Yeah, I need help. I need grace. So, but I've also needed to be informed and sometimes exhorted, sometimes confronted about things. So that's something I would try to do in as gentle a way as I could.
So tell me, how do you feel about contraceptives?
I think that a distinction has to be made between contraceptives and abortifacients. Abortifacients are things that may allow conception to take place, but then prevent the implantation of the embryo into the mother's uterus, which of course enables the embryo to get its nutrients and live and grow from there. But contraception means contra, you know, against, and conception, you know, contraconception is a shortened thing. But that prevents conception. So if you have a contraception like a condom that actually does prevent conception, I don't have it. That's not murder, okay? But abortifacients may try to prevent conception but have as a backup a chemical that prevents implantation. And now you're talking about aborting an early embryo. So the consistent pro-life stance would say that we oppose abortifacients. And I teach that to people. There are a lot of birth control pills, in fact, have a sort of plan A, prevent conception, plan B, prevent implantation, and therefore, who knows how many abortions are happening at that early embryonic stage because of the pill. Kylena, which is all over commercials on television right now, is an intrauterine device. Those are abortifacient. So, yeah, we take a very conservative pro-life stance about that.
You distinguish between two types of contraceptives. So do you think a high school should provide contraceptives in the first type to students?
Well, Isabel, I really don't think so. And I understand how unpopular this viewpoint is going to be just right at the outset. But I believe that handing out even contraception in the true sense tends to encourage promiscuity. One in four sexually active teens has an incurable sexually transmitted disease. That doesn't even count the curable ones. We have an epidemic that we won't call an epidemic because if we did, people would say, wait a minute, maybe the sexual revolution and sexual libertinism wasn't such a great idea after all. It's killing and harming people. So, to me, I don't think we should be encouraging sexual behavior, much less enabling it by handing them what it takes to have. And here's the thing. People get handed a condom and they're told that it's safe sex. If they're told that, well, it's not true. You can get it. The HPV virus goes through and around condoms. So people can get cervical cancer from the HPV virus, you know, but they thought they were practicing safe sex. There are multiple STDs you can get using these contraceptives that don't do anything to block several STDs. So for public health reasons, let alone the moral reasons, no, I wouldn't hand out contraceptives of any kind.
So you said that one in four teens are afflicted by an STD. What is your source on that?
Meg Meeker wrote a book called Epidemic, How Teen Sex is Killing Our Kids. And I believe she's an MD, and she documented that statistic in that book, along with a whole lot of other alarming stats on the subject.
Okay, and could you elaborate on the term libertinism?
Yes, libertinism. Sexual libertinism, you know, it's an extension of the word liberty, freedom. The notion of sexual freedom coming out of the sexual revolution, especially during the 60s, but let's be honest, it was in germ form before that. But sexual libertinism was an attempt to free people from conservative and especially Judeo-Christian sexual values that taught that sex was to be done within marriage and not outside of it, because the meaning of sex had to do with marital bonding and procreation. You know, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the animals and so forth. A vision of human flourishing as like children filling the earth and having this creation project that we take care of the earth and we take care of each other with our Father in heaven. So sexual libertinism was a flight from that traditional sexual ethic.
And of course, you said that handing out contraceptives would encourage teens to be more sexually active. And Why do you feel that way?
The difference between when people are taught from the moment they're born that sex is for marriage and why it is for marriage. I think you're a lot more likely to practice abstinence if you're taught that way than if you are handed a condom and essentially, you know, taught how to use it. And some of our, I don't say this in the sense of Brookings Harbor curricula, but I say it in the sense of, I've seen examples of curricula in high schools that encouraged experimentation. And in that context, when contraceptives are handed out, it's pretty clear that that kids are more likely to try those activities.
And to go back on abortions, would you want the government to prevent people from getting abortions?
I would. I think if we're going to prevent murder in outside of the womb, we should prevent murder inside of the womb. I mean, if I take my own pro-life view seriously, that you are human from the moment of conception until the moment of death, and the most important obligation of a government is to secure human lives. Governments don't give people the right to live. That's endowed by their creator. Governments are legitimate governments if they actually act on that to secure lives. So, granted, I would prefer it if everyone in the country wouldn't have an abortion if it were legal. I would prefer that no one would even want one, to be that informed. But in that case, it wouldn't matter what the law was. But I do believe that the law teaches, and that there are many women, as there are many men, who follow a law restricting abortion.
What do you think of the name pro-choice?
I have a couple of different thoughts about it. On the one hand, I have some common ground with pro-choice people in that I believe there are many choices relevant to having children that people ought to have. The choice of whether or not to engage in a sexual encounter, who to have sex with, when, how. If you do get pregnant, adoption or raising the child. I think there are many choices that people should have in all of this. Of course, I believe in freedom. I'm an American, for goodness sakes. But there's one choice, namely what we would call murder, that ought never to be allowed by any government. So we agree on a number of choice issues, but when the pro-choice person uses that rather than pro-abortion, say, they're using a euphemism. They're using a nice-sounding word in place of a really not nice word like abortion. And so now we're going to use a term like pro-choice or women's reproductive health or health care to cover up the dismemberment of human beings. We think that it conceals rather than reveals what's going on.
Could you tell us anything about abortion in the Bible?
I can. I'm a PhD candidate in biblical interpretation and theology, and I've worked this problem in a number of ways because there are a few texts that pro-choicers try to use to defend abortion from Scripture, and then some other texts that we think reflect pro-life view pretty strongly. I'll comment on the, I'll give you an example of each, okay? Let's say there's a passage in Exodus 21, 22 to 25. It says, if two men are fighting and hit a pregnant woman, accidentally, of course, and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the men are to be fined as the husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Lex talionis is the name of that that last bit at the end there. And it doesn't mean they're gouging out eyes, by the way. It means the punishment must fit the crime, and the context bears that out. But pro-choicers have mistranslated a key term in there, or if they imagine that it's not the woman gives birth prematurely, but the woman has a miscarriage, then, and there's no further harm, then applies to the woman. But you've got, so you have a dead fetus and a live mother, and there's only a fine. But if there is further injury to the mother, now you're life for life. Now you're the more serious penalty. And the NRSV reflects that issue.
So what is the NRSV?
Sorry, the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. There are different translations. But so what we have to do is go back to what the Hebrew term is. The Hebrew term is yasah. It means to come out, to go out. It's used of live births, but it's not used of miscarriages. The word shakal in Hebrew is the term for miscarriage. The author of Exodus knew it because he used it in 23. He used it a couple of times. So the fact that he used a term that just means come out rather than the term that means miscarriage, that's a pretty clear indication to me that he's talking about premature birth, which it might be likely that the child dies in that scenario, but it's not necessarily the case. It's possible if they're far enough along and the harm was just enough to cause premature birth, but not the death of the fetus. Anyway, so we believe that the fine that is to be leveled then is equal, whether it is the fetus that's harmed or the mother. And that's reflected in many of the modern translations, rightly so. But on the other side, you mentioned, if you want just one example of a pro-life type scripture, a lot of us look to Psalm 139, I am fearful and wonderfully made. And he's talking about while he's being formed within his mother's womb. The same personal pronoun in Hebrew, ani, I or me, is used of the psalmist before he's born and after he's born, which implies continuity of personal identity from conception through his adult life. And then, of course, the supreme example we look to is Jesus himself, who Christian theology has held for almost two millennia, that Jesus, that the Son of God became incarnate at the moment of the Immaculate Conception, not later, as the adoptionists had held. So we believe human life begins at conception in part because of the analogy of the incarnation of Jesus himself becoming human, fully human at conception.
If both parents are not ready to have a child, why should they be forced to pay for the mistake that they made at the time?
Well, suppose we substituted a toddler into this situation and you have a set of parents who are terrible, but they've got this 2-year-old little girl. They're not ready to be parents, but they are. Is it okay for them to kill that little girl on that argument? Well, no pro-choicer would say yes to that. Of course, no one. So why is it different in the case of abortion? Well, the pro-choice person would no doubt think or say, because the unborn are not fully human or not persons, but the toddler, the little girl is. And we would say, so you're just assuming that the unborn are not persons. You can't just assume that in an argument when that's the whole issue. That's begging the most important question. If you're going to try to persuade a pro-life person like me of your position, you have to attack the essence of our position, which is that the unborn are fully human persons. You can't just offer an argument that assumes they're not.
This is KCIWLP out of Brookings, Oregon, broadcasting on 100.7 FM. I'm Isabella Freitas, and this is an interview with Pastor Jim Schultz. So, what do you think of abortion on a case where a woman may have been raped?
Rape is tragic. It's frustrating to me that rapists sometimes, almost get away with it. In terms of how light some of the penalties are, I've heard too many stories of rapists who serve too little time. I think it should be a capital crime, but I'm digressing just a bit. I think we should do more to prevent it from the standpoint of penalties, but I also think we should do more to prevent rape in terms of training men, especially. Men are more visual than women, in my opinion, but both sexes are visual to some extent. And I think that our pornographic culture feeds desires that aren't satisfied by their feeding. It grows their desires more. And then you have some of them, at least, acting in this way. I think that more needs to be done to prevent rape. But the question I come to is, granted that a woman or a girl was raped and became pregnant, how should a just and compassionate society deal with that? Should we deal with that by killing someone who is innocent? Or should we deal with that with offering to come alongside, to assist her, to comfort her, to offer adoption or other ways to come alongside her? I've done a lot of pastoral counseling in my life. I've been the pastor of our church here, Lighthouse Assembly of God, for almost 15 years, and people come in with all sorts of different challenges. And the love of a church, the love of a family, can go a long way toward healing some incredibly terrible things that happen, spousal abuse and adultery and rape as well.
So you mentioned the Lighthouse Assembly of God. Do you think you could tell us more about that?
Yeah, Lighthouse Assembly of God was started back in about 1959. It's been around almost 60 years, and it has helped a lot of people to know the gospel of Jesus Christ, of course, and to come into community with one another, and to, you know, people bear one another's burdens and help each other financially, and we try to strengthen each other morally and in our relationships with God, and we think a lot of good and compassionate things have come out of the existence of Lighthouse. People have gone on missions trips and raised money for wells in Africa, in communities where people didn't have access to clean water. I mean, a lot of things have, good things have come out of that church, and I'm very proud of our people for that reason.
What is the denomination of the Lighthouse Assembly of God?
Yeah, it's an Assemblies of God church, which is a Protestant denomination, and within that subset of Protestant, it is conservative evangelical, which is to say that we believe in the physical resurrection of Jesus and the absolute necessity of believing, having faith in Jesus to be saved and that sort of thing. So it's Protestant evangelical, and then within that subset evangelical, we are Pentecostal, which means that we believe that certain spiritual gifts are valid for today. Say, the gift of healing and the gift of prophecy and things like that.
So what state or national organizations are you a member of?
I speak for Life Training Institute, LTI, and you can look us up at prolifetraining.com. And LTI trains people to speak for life. And we speak in schools and at pregnancy care center banquets and anywhere we can. We'll speak to pro-choice people and make the case on hostile turf, but we'll also speak in Christian schools to students in order to teach them the case, and so that they have a chance to weigh the scientific and philosophical case for life. But also for those who are pro-life, it trains them in how to make a good persuasive pro-life case on premises that they have in common with many pro-choice people. Too many Christians want to make their case from a Bible that that some pro-choice people don't even believe. So how is that going to, how can you persuade someone to believe something they don't believe on the basis of something else they don't believe? So I believe in finding common ground, and you have to do that by asking questions and listening and finding out what another person actually thinks. And then whatever they think that you think is true, that's common ground, and you build your case from there. So that we train people in that type of reasoning. At LTI, we've heard a lot of different approaches to pro-life apologetics, which is the defense of the pro-life position intellectually. And we have a particular way that we want to make this case that avoids some of the weaker ways that pro-lifers do things, and that stays on topic, that frames the debate to be about the unborn. What is the unborn and what happens during an abortion? Those are the paramount issues that our case really stands or falls on those issues. Does that make sense? Yeah. So anyway, Life Training Institute is the short answer to your question. Scott Klusendorf founded that organization. He's an exceptional author and pro-life speaker, and he trained me last fall. If you look up their organization online, I'm not even on there yet because I'm brand new to this thing. But I've been doing some pro-life advocacy before. I spoke in the health class in this school, I don't know, 6-7 years ago at least.
Oh, I wasn't here.
Yeah, you weren't here back then, right? But I was. One of the options the student had was to, all the students had the option of inviting a guest speaker to be part of their presentation on whatever topic they wanted. And Jules Heredia invited me to present as she did the visual parts and stuff. And yeah, I had like 45, 50 minutes to make the case. And much to my surprise, there wasn't a single student who was willing to try to defend abortion when I opened it up for questions and answers. I thought for sure we'd have some people push back on some things, but I mean, I had abortion instruments. I showed them. I walked them through the process, and they didn't want to defend it.
Earlier, you mentioned hostile turf, and I don't think many people know that arguments like this could get hostile. So what is some hostility you have received for your views in the past?
I'll give you one example. On Facebook, I'll use social media to put videos or remarks or arguments about social issues, including abortion, out there. And I did that one day. I believe I was sharing one of the Center for Medical Progress Planned Parenthood expose videos, where they went in and they filmed conversations with Planned Parenthood employees that revealed that Planned Parenthood was selling body parts for profit. And when I shared that video, I got some serious blowback from a couple of people. One of them I knew, and then one of her friends I didn't know kind of got in there, and her friend really kind of came at me in a personal way, you know, for being a man, for one thing, and having the nerve to have an opinion about the issue. Insulting me at times, just, you know, I made arguments, and her arguments didn't dissuade me. I tried to show where her arguments were fallacious. And instead of sort of following the logic with me, she resorted to personal attacks about, well, he's closed-minded, you know, he's never going to change his mind, and that sort of thing. It's not a big deal. I actually don't mind people insulting me in this context. I'm going to give you a secret. It reveals something. If I'm making good arguments, or at least trying to stay very rational and calm and gracious, and they're attacking me, they're forfeiting their opportunity to make a good argument back. And I'm winning. And I'll tell you, I'll keep the score. I'll let people listening know that I'm winning. Oh, you haven't refuted my second premise, that abortion intentionally kills an innocent human being. Not because I want to win an argument for my own ego, but because I want people to know the difference between a good and bad argument. I shouldn't say this, but I'm gonna. I find too much feeling and too little logical thinking these days. I sort of identify with that line from the Chronicles of Narnia, you know, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, when the professor looks at the older kids and says, you know, because they're not following the logic of this argument he's sort of laying out. And he says, what are they teaching in schools these days? Are they teaching logic at all? Sometimes I wonder. But then I hear these really logical arguments from kids, and then I'm encouraged again. So, but I find some poor reasoning in these debates by pro-lifers and pro-choicers. And I want to train the pro-lifers, and I want to challenge the pro-choicers. Let's make a real argument, not in the sense that creates more heat than light, but in the sense that we're having a rational dialogue, and we give and take, and we ask questions, we listen to each other, and we show some respect, and we try to deal with evidence and good arguments. We're not going to get anywhere in this debate in America with just shouting at each other and cutting each other down. I think the lack of civility is a tragic thing.
When you were talking about the Facebook video you shared, and it was the person you know and her friend was coming at you, as you said, and then she was talking about how, like, she said something like, how dare you have an opinion when you are male? And what do you think you would say to, like, refute an argument like that? Like, why do you have an opinion about a woman's health issue if you are male?
I would say, then you better throw out Roe versus Wade, because that was decided by 9 men on the Supreme Court. I would say, oh, on that logic, civilians can't have any sort of opinion that we vocalize that matters about a war overseas. If you're not military, you're not, this isn't your business. I think it's actually an absurd attempt to silence us rather than our argument. And besides, I was trained in bioethics by Paige Comstock Cunningham at Trinity International University, who has both a law degree and now a PhD. So she used the same arguments that male pro-lifers like Francis Beckwith and Scott Klusendorf and Robert George from Princeton and all these other, they're the same arguments. And many of the people I've worked with in the pro-life movement have been women, including women who have had abortions. So I don't see the relevance. Arguments don't have genders. People do.
You mentioned bioethics. Would you like to elaborate on what that is?
Yeah, bioethics. Ethics, of course, you know what that is, but bio is life. So ethical issues related to life is what you study in bioethics. So that includes some of those things we mentioned earlier. It's abortion, it's euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, assisted reproduction, a number of those kinds of issues that relate to the ethics of what to do with life. So, you know, medical ethics is another thing that, you know, people will call it that sometimes.
So what is coming up next for the Life Training Institute?
Well, we have, I think it's over a dozen of us. There, a handful are full-time speakers and others are part-time, volunteers like myself. And what we're always trying to do is get into schools, which includes high schools and especially Christian schools, but public as well, universities, and speak at other events, Right to Life conventions, Oregon Right to Life, and, you know, all of these sorts of things. We're always just trying to get into as many places as we can. And Scott Klusendorf, our president, gets appointments overseas. And so he'll go to Great Britain or wherever else around the world and speak and train students in these sorts of things as well. We give talks on objective moral values. That is, we argue against relativism, the belief that there are no real objective moral values that apply to everyone, whether they believe in them or not. We argue for objective moral values, that there are moral values that apply to absolutely everyone, whether they know or agree with them or not. And so we give lectures on those things, on other bioethical issues, on abortion, on you know, just all the related things. But it's kind of in that narrow range. So basically, the answer to your question is we are just constantly on the phone and on the email and just trying contacting schools and places and trying to get speaking events, because we find that an alarmingly low percentage of Christian students, or, you know, students from Christian schools, actually ever hear a good evidence-based case for the pro-life position. And so then they go on to universities and they get term alert. They get cultural Marxism and radical feminism, all these other isms thrown at them, and they don't know what to do. It's like they're adrift at sea and not knowing how to respond, because the smartest people they've ever heard in their lives are arguing against what they've been taught all their lives. So we try to prepare students for the worldview challenges they'll face in universities. That's why I also teach part-time at the Christian school. My wife is the principal of Brookings Harbor Christian School up Cape Farello, and she's nice enough to let me teach the high school. And I've done this for a number of years now. I've got both my daughters in my class. How cool is that, right? But I get to teach them philosophy and historical issues and sociology and psychology and all these from the Christian worldview. But I also compare it with the Marxist and secular humanist and Islamic and postmodernist and some of these other worldviews to teach them how to think critically and evaluate worldviews philosophically. I love it. And they get college credit for it too. So how cool is that?
Could you give us a definition for cultural Marxism?
Okay, let's go from Marxism itself, which the focus of Karl Marx was on economics and economic classes, and most importantly, the two. You can say the oppressors and the oppressed. He said bourgeoisie and proletariat, but let's go ahead and say oppressed and oppressors. And he was trying to help the oppressed against the oppressors by the economic redistribution of wealth and all those kinds of things. Cultural Marxist, if you read, there's a book called Marxism After Marx, and he explains how there's a family tree from Marx 150 years, give or take, ago, down to all sorts of different schools of thought that have been heavily influenced by Marxism, because worldviews change over time. In the United States, the form that Marxism tended to take was it expanded from just the economic class struggles to issues of race. This race is being oppressed by that race. Gender. This gender is being oppressed by that gender. Obviously, females oppressed by males. And other cultural issues. Now, of course, we've expanded it much further to sexual orientation type things where, this orientation of person is being oppressed by that orientation. And strategies of class warfare come up, and it's, okay, we got to get everybody to revolt against, the perceived oppressors. And that's cultural Marxism. I mean, people don't call it that usually, but people who think worldviewishly do. I mean, people who know what Marxism is can identify that. We don't use that as a pejorative, like a cut down. We're just being honest about where the idea came from. That's the family tree. And then, of course, we object to a number of things that come out of Marxism for a variety of philosophical reasons, but moral reasons. In fact, we see a lot. I think the primary reason people are pro-choice is ultimately a Marxist-inspired argument. That is proletariat morality. Whatever helps the oppressed against the oppressor is right, and whatever hurts them against in their struggle against the oppressor is wrong. That's the very form of the social justice or gender justice argument for abortion. That abortion should be legal because if we are going to achieve women's equality and justice, that's the end. That's the purpose. That's the goal. Then we have to have this means available, abortion. That's the ends justify the means. And if it's a good end, then it justifies what it takes to get it. That's we call that act utilitarianism. The main problem with it, of course, is that you can use that argument to justify torturing detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And most pro-choice people would say, that's wrong. And we'd say, why? Well, because they have human rights. They do have human rights. So human rights applies to the unborn as well. If they use the gender justice argument to justify abortion, they're assuming the unborn are not human and therefore begging the question. And they need to provide an argument for why the unborn aren't human rather than getting us all over here trying to embrace an act utilitarian argument. Utilitarianism is at the end justifies the means. We're trying to create as much happiness for as many people as possible and as little suffering for as many people as possible. But our point is we reject arguments like, in fact, it's not just pro-lifers, it's not just Christians and conservatives who reject that kind of argumentation. I can take you to a secular, if you want to call it that, a bioethics text not written by Christians, where they reject and they offer a whole bunch of arguments against utilitarianism. So anyway, that's a long answer to your question, I guess. But it exposes some of the interesting issues, right? Hopefully.
How could people find out more about Life Training Institute?
Well, go online to prolifetraining.com. That's the main website. Tell you about our speakers. It actually summarizes our argument on some places on the website. It will also link you to caseforlife.com, which develops some of our arguments, has some of the embryology quotes and some of the pictures of embryos developing. A number of different things on both of those websites. You can also, of course, get on YouTube and watch videos of some of our presentations or Vimeo. Some of the presenters put their stuff on Vimeo and they've got links right on there on those websites to those videos. My video, though, is on YouTube. I did an event here, a Respect for Life rally a month ago here at Star of the Sea Catholic Church in Brookings. I was the main speaker there, and my presentation is right there on YouTube. You can find it by just looking up a case for the pro-life position, Jim Schultz, S-C-H-U-L-T-Z, and you'll find it on there. And it's about a 48-minute summary. Some of the stuff I mentioned here and some other stuff as well. And then, of course, you can get on the LTI website and get Scott Klusendorf's book, The Case for Life. And it goes into great detail about all this and then some. So lots of good resources out there to find out.
I think that concludes our interview. So I would like to thank you, Mr. Schultz, for coming in and letting me interview you and ask the questions provided to us by all of our students here.
Thank you, Isabella, for having me. I enjoyed our time.
You're welcome.
After completing this interview, several student journalists expressed interest in researching the topics discussed with Mr. Schultz. Bruin News has tentative plans to share the findings of our student researchers in a later episode. Bruin News endeavors to research and verify claims and statements, and then share the information we find. Whether our findings prove the claims true or false, we believe we have an obligation as journalists to share those findings with you. Stay tuned. You've just listened to an episode of Bruin Radio Interviews, an hour-long interview show brought to you by the students and staff of the Brookings Harbor High School in partnership with Curry Coast Community Radio, KCIW. Content for this program is provided by the Brookings Harbor High School. To view the credits for this episode, visit kciw.org/credits.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program. The information provided is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek the advice of your personal physician or other qualified health care professional before changing your health care treatment, diet, or lifestyle.
Brian, they ain't playing nothing on the radio today, Cletus.
Well, Jeffro, you only think that because you ain't tuned in to something you like. Now, what you after?
Well, I'll tell you, Cletus, I'm awful tired of these pop songs and advertising commercials. I just want to hear something real, something with spirit, you know? Something with flavor.
Well, heck, Jeffro, and why don't you twisty that tuny dial to 100.7
FM? 100.7
FM?
Who the heck is that, Cletus?
Well, that's KCIWLP, you dummy. Curry Coast Community Radio.
Oh, community radio? Oh, geez, Cletus, isn't that going to be just a bunch of hippie come together? Talk?
Well, of course not, Jeffro. Well, at least not all the time. It's all kinds of shows from all kinds of folk around here. It's anything at all from our community leader interviews, high school student comedy sketches, local news gathered by local people, and music from all over the world.
Well, hey, Cletus, that sounds just like the kind of real spirited and flavorful programming my distinguished sense of taste has been hungry for.
Well, twisty on that dial, Jeffro. Let's give a listen to KCIWLP. Woo-wee!
Yeah, boy, that's the stuff. 100.7, yeah, that's better than PBR!
Say, Sandy, I thought KCIW was a radio station.
Well, sure it's a radio station, Jonas. We play music and interviews and news.
Yeah, but where are your commercials? Your advertising? I never hear any.
You mean you want to hear ads?
Yeah. Hammy advertisements for local businesses, a radio DJ endorsing a product she's never tried, Barbasol shaving cream, Lucky Strike cigarettes, instant pothole fillers.
Well, KCIW doesn't play advertisements or commercials like that. We don't need to.
What? How's that possible? It costs money to stay on the air. All the rental fees and equipment maintenance.
Well, sure it costs money, Jonas, but KCIW is a community radio station, and it's run by a nonprofit, Curry Coast Community Radio. We fundraise, and we ask for donations to stay on the air.
I don't see that making much of a profit.
Profit's not the point or the goal. Community radio is a medium for members of its community to get their voice heard, at no cost to them. When a person donates to KCIW, they're making sure the medium of radio remains open to all our Wild Rivers Coast show hosts, interview guests, musicians, poets, and composers.
Oh, well, all right, that all sounds pretty great. I still miss my Barbasol commercials, though.
Oh, Jonas, we need to get you a hobby.
There. This is Bruce Ellis with the Insider Report, and I'm inviting you all to tune in to my show here on the little station that could, KCIWLP 100.7 FM on your radio dial on a daily basis, 6 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. That's the Insider Report, the show that keeps you in the know.
You're listening to KCIWLP out of Brookings, Oregon, broadcasting on 100.7 FM.